listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kourula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, Mr. Kenny Lee Lewis, guitar extraordinaire. How are you, Kenny?
I'm doing great, man. Just trying to catch up with all you young folks with all this high tech stuff.
You know what? You're doing great, and that's all that matters. You and I go way back, and I've seen you like some, but let's go way back. You are quite a musician. You play a number of instruments, guitar, bass being two of them, but... when did you first pick up the guitar and want to start playing? What was your moment of zen?
Well, after learning the ukulele when I was about 7 or 8 and trying to play with my brother and sister at family functions, I had the bug, but I really wanted to play guitar and my hand was too small. So when I, you know, got old enough, around 12, I think, 11 or 12, I picked up my brother's Peter Paul Mary songbook and his silver tone guitar, which I still own, that's in my bedroom right now. And I was able to get my hand around this massive neck, which has no truss rod, you know, big giant baseball bat. And I was able to start forming the chords, and I started learning some of the songs by putting my fingers where the dots were and stuff, you know. And so that was just sort of like a folky thing, because my brother and sister were folkies. They were into Peter Paul and Mary, the Brothers Four.
They were showing you chords and things, or were you just like on your own?
Ian, Sylvia, Dylan, you know, I mean, that was their bag, you know. It was kind of like post-beatnik. And that's all I really knew, although I did like the Beach Boys, but on a nylon string silver tone, you can't get into the Beach Boys. You know, you got to have that Fender amp and that Jaguar guitar or whatever. And it's like, I never made that transition. But then when the Beatles hit, and then the Stones hit, and then the Kinks and the Yardbirds hit, I realized that I needed to start getting into electric guitar. And so that's when I finally borrowed a Harmony electric guitar and amp from a buddy of mine's brother, who was kind of in high school by then. We were little kids. I was like still in grammar school, I think 6th grade. This was in Sacramento, California, capital of this great state. And I borrowed this guitar and amp, and I started woodshedding, and the guy next door to me had an amp and a guitar, but the thing that he had that nobody else had was a bomb shelter.
Oh, wow.
He had like a cold bomb shelter that came in the house and they bought it. They didn't build it, but they found it. They found the little, you know, the little wheel and everything out behind the bush and went down it, and it had bunks in it, and it had like a hand crank air pump and everything. So we'd go down there. In the summer between 66, 67, between 6th and 7th grade, we took a 45 player down there, and we just stayed all down there all summer and just blasted our guitars in this real echoey room that sounded really great for guitars. And that's when I really started to learn how to play electric guitar. And then I was able to, like, start emulating, you know, House of the Rising Sun and, you know, Rave Up with the Yardbirds and the Kinks. And, you know, that was what I started with, you know, and I had an affinity for it. I felt that I had a gift that allowed me to play fretted instruments pretty easily. I don't know whether it was because of the uke or whether it was already there before I was born, but I just felt really comfortable playing fretted instruments. I didn't have any problem getting around on them. So that's kind of how it started.
And did you have any help? Like, did your brothers and sisters teach you chords, or were you just kind of doing it all by ear on your own?
My dad played a little guitar. He played drums. He also played sax that I never saw. He did that one before I was born. Wow. But he showed me a few chords. But my brother was the one who probably showed me the most chords. But like I said, I was pretty self-taught. I bought a ukulele book when I was 7 or 8, and with that ukulele and learned how to put my fingers in the right spots, use the felt pick. You know, I was singing old black spirituals, Sweet Home Swing Chariot, and Old Black Joe when I was 7 years old.
Wow, that's crazy.
I had that gift, you know, Saints Come Marching In, you know. It's a,
So it was developing your ear. You were kind of starting to hear the differences in pitches. And
yeah, and my dad played swing music all the time. He was always playing Count Basie and Louis Belson on the drums. And, you know, he was playing Benny Goodman and, you know, Woody Herman and you know, Artie Shaw. I mean, I grew up with swing in my bones because it was playing in the house all the time.
That's awesome.
That was part of my education, was just listening to my dad's record collection.
And then did you guys start a band in that bomb shelter? Or, like, how did it
all two of us, and he was a year older, and he kind of drifted away because he wanted to get away from me because I was a year younger, and he wanted to hang out with the older guys. So we sort of broke away from each other. But then I met some guys in the seventh grade, and I started a band, yes. And Rick Enos was a buddy of mine. He had an amp and a guitar. The Sherman brothers were left over from my grammar school, and even though they went to a new junior high school, they still would come over and play with me, which I thought was really nice. So we had four guitars, and then this one guy who was kind of a handicapped, you know, he had brace on his leg. He said he could play drums. My brother had a Gretsch snare and a cymbal that he left when he went off and got married. He left them in the house. So that was our drum kit, was a snare and one cymbal. We had this band after school called The Abdomen.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah. I was just about to ask what the name was.
And we were learning, Satisfaction and, Another Stones tune. What was it? Gloria, Secret Agent Man, that kind of stuff. And so we started practicing after school. Between the time I'd get out of school, my mom would be coming home from her job. We had about an hour window where we could make a bunch of noise before my parents would kick everybody out.
That's awesome. And you were diligent about practicing. You knew kind of then that you wanted to do that.
Just learning chords and the riffs, you know, like Secret Agent Man was like, you know, that was a riff, you know, that was Johnny Rivers playing on his 345, you know, and so you had to learn that riff, you know, to get that. It was pretty cool. And then, of course, you know, we're doing the 007 thing, Peter Gunn, you know, these were things that we started learning. Yeah, and we would play them for an hour, you know, and it was like we didn't sing. We didn't have a PA. And if we did sing, we just kind of shouted. And then the Monkees came out, and we started learning the Monkees songs.
Classic.
I'm Not Your Stepping Stone, Last Train to Clarksville, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we had a repertoire. It was kind of fun, but we never got a gig. We never did anything with that band. And then one day I went to a dance at the school, and one of my classmates was a drummer. And he was in a band with a bunch of older guys. And I can't remember them, but Ron Duval was the guitar player. Ron DuPaul, that was his name, I think. Anyway, but they were older guys. They were already like 9th, 10th grade in high school, you know. And we were 7th graders, you know. And so I went there and I heard these guys. They had a PA. And they were playing, you know, not only were they doing, you know, Knock on Wood, Midnight Hour, all that stuff. They were doing some Hendrix and some Beatle tunes.
Oh, wow.
It's like, whoa. It was really cool. And I got to stand right up next to him and look at him. Talked to John, the drummer, on a break. And he was kind of short with me because, you know, he could tell I was just some novice. But he kind of said, yeah. Come over to my house sometime. I got a great record collection. I'll show you what my family's all about. Come to find out, his family were all musicians, professional musicians that lived in L.A. and stuff. And they sort of took me in as an orphan and started teaching me the ropes of the studio industry in Los Angeles, which, of course, I had to eventually go down and visit. And I did, I think, the next year. And it was just...
You must have been about 16, 17?
No. I was only about 14.
Wow. That's crazy.
7th, 8th grade, you know.
And, you know, this is an important factor that most people won't understand. When you're learning all these songs, there was no CD player and there was no MP3s. You were doing it all with vinyl, I assume, right? So you had to turn the records back or move the needles every time you had to hear a lick. Right?
Speed on the phonograph. You know, you changed down to 16. If you had a 45, you changed it down to 33. If you had a 33 LP, you changed it down to 16. And you'd learn these songs one note at a time, riff by riff. And this is before I started learning how to read guitar notation. That came a little later, not long after that, though. And because I started taking lessons and whatnot. But, you know, still the guitars were we had no fuzz boxes. The amps were really crappy little 10-watt little Japanese things that, you know, might have had vibrato and reverb, but there wasn't any gain in them or anything. And so when we'd hear those power chords like on Cream and Hendrix, we go, how'd they get that? And that's when I discovered the Boss Tone, which was the little 9-volt battery little box. It had two knobs on it. You'd plug it right into the guitar, and, you know, it was about 2-inch square. And, man, I mean, you put those batteries, I think it was a 9-volt battery. I think 9-volt battery was just known. And it had gain and volume. And, man, it was a pretty cool sound of Fuzz Tone. And so now we were, equipped to for mayhem, you know, with this Fuzz Tone. So that's when that started, you know. And so that's when I started emulating, you know, Hendrix and Beck and Page, Clapton, you know.
Did you ever get to see any of those guys in that heyday?
Yeah, Cream played Sac State.
Oh my God!
And Hendrix did too. In 1968. Yeah, we got to see them in a basketball gym at Sac
State. What?
Yeah.
Oh my God!
Hendrix came in a Country Squire station wagon, and I think they got him for $3,000.
What?
Yeah, my friend Skip, you know, Skip's Music in Sacramento was a well-known music store, and we used to babysit his kids, and he was the guy that brought him in and promoted the gig.
That is wild. So that must have been kind of life-changing, seeing all that.
It was 68.
So do you remember, like, I mean, you must have been super young, but do you remember how kind of like how that experience was, seeing all those cats? I mean, those are like the king of
skin. Yeah, no, I mean, it was like a go to church, you know, and it was like, you'd look at the stage and it was like, oh, started going to festivals. I remember going over to the Pleasanton Pop Festival, seeing Deep Purple with Richie Blackmore with a Stratocaster on a slip strap going around like this around his neck. And I'm like going, oh my God, I want to be him, you know?
So did you ever feel like there was one player that you were gravitating more towards, or was it kind of a jambalaya?
At first it was all the English guys, but the English guys were kind of like from another planet. They were kind of skinny and they were really emaciated and they smoked cigarettes and they wore all black shit. And I was just a flag football player, a big kid, you know. I mean, I ate donuts. I mean, come on.
Right.
Like the first person I saw that I went, wow, he looks kind of like me, believe it or not, was Steve Miller.
Oh, wow.
You know, because he had a big face. He's, you know, kind of a stocky German guy. And I saw him on stage at Sacramento Memorial Auditorium, I think later that year. And this was after Boz had left. It was just a trio. It was just him and Lonnie and Tim. He played mostly harmonica all night.
What?
Yeah, because, you know, he wanted to be Paul Butterfield. It's pretty funny. But when I saw him, I went, I'm going to work with you someday, you know, and of course they were passing a joint around. I got stoned for the first time, you know, I said, I'm going to work with you someday. And I'm thinking that I'm having a conversation with him. Like, I'm thinking he's looking at me and he didn't even, I mean, I told him the story, he just laughed. I said, obviously you don't remember we had a conversation. But I was having the conversation internally, which was like the refrigerator magnet, which was that I was going to work with him someday.
And what was the reason that you gravitated towards his music or his vibe so much?
Because he could sing, and he sang bluesy, and the sound of his voice was high tenor, which was unusual for then, except for, you know, of course, Robert Plant, which was just screaming.
Right.
The music he played swung, and because I grew up around swing music, around my father, when he would play a shuffle, it sounded like a real shuffle.
Right.
You listen to the San Francisco bands like Quicksilver and Airplane and The Dead. You know, they try to do a shuffle, and it just sounded like shit. They didn't know how to play that stuff.
And the songwriting and arrangements are there, too.
I heard that first album on the very first pirate radio station that was coming in from San Francisco, which was called KSAN, KSAN. Tom Donahue was a program director. And I could just barely get it at my house, but late at night, I put on my Dave Clark headphones, you know, and my parents thought I was asleep, and I go under the covers, and I hear Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, and then I hear Cream and, you know, the Yardbirds and Shapes, and then I heard Steve Miller's first album, you know, Children of the Future, and he had like fog horns and sound effects, and they were singing through Leslie's, and it was all stereo, and it was like, man, I mean, I got freaked out, man. I mean, this is before I was getting high, you know. Right. I was just getting high on the music, you know.
Right. And how old are you? How old are you when you met him?
We'd go off the air at midnight, and I'd be all sad, and I'd be all depressed until I'd come on air the next day.
How old were you when you first met Steve Miller?
Oh, that was years later. I didn't meet him until 1981 when I was already an established studio bass player.
That's crazy. So when did you pick up bass? I've got two questions. When did the abdomen break up, and when did you start playing bass?
Well, the abdomen broke up around the time that just before the abdomen was put together. I mean, I was still in the sixth grade, but this was before junior high. I had gone to my sixth grade class, and there was a band. I had changed schools mid-year, like I was starting January. And I was coming into this last semester of sixth grade at a school down in South Sac. And I went to my room that I was supposed to check in, and it was recess. But when I looked inside the room, there was a band in there, and they were practicing, and they were playing electric guitars and amp. And the lead singer had a German helmet on and boots, like high boots. And he was singing an original song. And his name was Bruce Leno. And I, of course, I hadn't met him yet. But, you know, when the bell rang, they grabbed all their stuff and threw it into a locker and sat down. And so on the recess after that, or when school went on, I befriended him. I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, we were practicing because there's a talent show coming up here at the school, and we want to win. And we're practicing my song, Santa's Supercharged Sleigh, that I just wrote. And I went like, wow, that is so cool. And so eventually I got invited to a birthday party of the drummer that was in that band. And I got to go to this party. It was my very first rock party. My parents made me wear a white shirt and slacks and hard shoes. I get there. This is around 1966. Okay. These kids were hip. They were wearing paisley, tie-dye, army jackets, you know. Yeah, I mean, these kids were already in the San Francisco scene, man, because it was only an hour away. Well, I'd never been over there. I didn't know anything about hippies or smoking weed or anything.
What an era, too. What an era.
Because the drummer got drunk. He snuck some booze out of his parents' liquor case, and he got sick, and he had to go around the back of the garage, and his girlfriend was holding him, and he was throwing up in the back. And the band, which was this band that I saw in that classroom, was the band playing that day, because, of course, he was the drummer. It was his birthday. So he couldn't play his own drum. So the bully there's a lot of other stories that I could tell you, too, but there was a bully at the school. I was just looking at the drum set while he was trying to recover, and they were trying to play a 45 with a mic. It wasn't good. They wanted the band to play, and I'm sitting there looking at the drums, and the bully looks at me, and he's already punched me once, you know, so I don't want to mess with this guy. And he looks at me and goes, you play the drums? I said, no, not really. No, I don't play the drums. He goes, do you have any drums? I says, well, yeah, my brother has a snare drum you left at the house. He goes, well, then you're playing these drums right now. It's like this. And he was threatening to beat my ass if I didn't play the drums.
Wow.
So I got on the drums, which I'd never sat down on a traps kit before. I'd only practiced rudiments and little goofy shit on the snare. And the band was looking out of the garage out towards the driveway where all the kids were. They never turned around to see that I had been put up the drums. So they count off Gloria or, you know, Satisfaction, some song. And I just start playing, you know, because the guys over there going like this, right? And so my debut on stage with a rock band was on drums.
That is wild.
And they never turned around. I left the next song.
Well, you were doing it right. You were doing it right.
They never turned around. And it's about three songs in until finally one of them went, hey, Jamie, because they thought Jamie was playing.
Wow.
The regular drummer. So they turned around and go, hey, Jamie, who are you? What are you doing on Jamie's drums? Get off his drum. And then Pete Drady, the bully, said, it's okay, guys. He's been playing the last three songs. Leave him alone. He's doing a good job.
How did you know how to play the parts? That's crazy.
And being in a rock band. But anyway, to get back to your question about bass, that singer of that band, Bruce, was a great songwriter, and he was a guitar player. But he also played a little bass just for fun. So eventually he and I started a band. This was, you know, right around the time the Abdomen broke up. We started another band called Friar Tuck with a drummer that I met in seventh grade there. So Friar Tuck was me on guitar mostly, Bruce on bass, because I was a better lead player than him. But he wrote songs. And when he wrote songs, he wanted to play guitar because it was a harmonic instrument that he felt more in tune with when he was playing guitar. So I would pick up the bass and play the bass on his original songs. And then he would just play like little chord solos or something. But when we were doing the Cream or the Hendrix or any of that stuff, I'd go back over to guitar and play all that lead stuff. And he'd play the bass. So all throughout our early career, if you want to call it that, from the time we were in junior high all the way through high school up into college, Bruce and I flip-flopped on bass and guitar back and forth on stage every gig. This was for years. So we learned both instruments simultaneously.
That's not easy, too, because, like, bass is a totally different animal to me. I mean, I can mess around on bass, but I would never get on stage and just start playing.
Well, you know, when I teach either instrument, I teach that rhythm guitar is very closely related to bass. Not lead guitar, not standing up there playing all the histrionic stuff. Rhythm guitar playing, both the harmonic structure and the rhythm of learning rhythm guitar is very closely related to what a bass does. So, and the same in reverse. If you're a bass player and you know some patterns, and you can transfer that over to guitar, you're basically becoming a rhythm guitar player,
right?
Like a Steve Cropper kind of rhythm guitar player. Oh. And so they're very closely related. So, but a lot of people that are lead players don't make that jump to being a really great rhythm player, believe it or not. I mean, there's a lot of, I know a lot of, I'm not going to name names, but there's a lot of great lead guitar players that I know in the industry that are very famous that are terrible rhythm guitar players.
Yes, that happens a lot because they don't focus on the lead playing.
They just don't have the gene to get in the pocket and in the groove and drive the band that way. They're always rushing. Their patterns are strange. They go between lead and chords. You know, it's like you have to do one or the other and just stay there. You know,
it's very true.
So that's how I learned how to play bass.
And so you moved to Los Angeles. How old were you when you moved to Los Angeles?
I moved to Los Angeles on New Year's Day of 1973. Wow. I had been going to college. I had played in the jazz band there for a year.
Where'd you go to college?
Consumers River College was a junior college. Had a great jazz program. I graduated a semester early from high school. I took summer school, and I got out of there. And so when everybody was trying to figure out how to invite to the senior ball, I was like playing in the jazz band at college.
That's awesome.
I learned how to read notation. And I also played both bass and guitar with the jazz band, whatever they needed. But mostly it was guitar. And I learned how to read notation. I learned flute to learn the register of guitar because it's the same. And then I learned how to play baritone horn trombone because it's in the same register as electric bass. And so I learned both those and played in the concert orchestra so I could learn how to read better with those instruments so I could transfer that over to guitar and bass.
And what were you playing? Were you doing like Wes Montgomery, stuff like that?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, like we were doing, you know, like, man, we were doing all kinds of cool stuff in that band. We went to Reno and we did the jazz fest there. We became in second place to De Anza College, which was just ridiculous. So they had an A, B, and a C band.
Wow.
And all three of those bands took first, second, third place. So really, we took fourth place. But the answer took all three of those. And there was a guitar player, a young guy, that played jazz guitar like Herb Ellis, you know, Wes Montgomery style. He played in all three of those bands, and he was fantastic. And I was so impressed. He was playing a jazz box. You know, he was playing like in a big hollow body with flat wilds with a Y-on-G. I went out and got a 1949 L4C, put Johnny Smith pickups on it. And that's what I started learning how to play jazz on.
So jazz has always been ingrained in you.
With flat ones.
All this time, jazz has always been a major voice for you.
Yeah. But you asked another question earlier, who were my influences? After it was, you know, the English guys, it was Steve Miller. But then when Chicago came out, Terry Kath was my guy. Because Terry looked a little bit like me and Steve. He was another big-faced Polish guy, whatever. And he played that hybrid between Hendrixian style, free-form psychedelic blues, but he also could come outside the box and play those jazz runs like he did on, you know, Make Me Smile and 25 or 64 and those songs. I mean, he was playing jazzy stuff, you know, in a horn band. And so he became my sort of my mentor for quite a while.
And then did you started doing auditions once you were in LA, like for studio sessions? How did you get into that work?
It was a slow process. It was just like all of us at Guitar Center, you know, I got a job at Splevin's Music, Wallach City out in Topanga Plaza. This was in 1973. I was going to CSUN because CSUN had a great jazz program. But when I went to CSUN to audition for their band, you know, the day that they were auditioning people, it was like 50 guys in a row, all my age now, you know, 50, 60-year-old guys with L4s and L5s, you know, lottery classics, is they were studio cats that wanted to play big band music. So they wanted to get it in the big band at CSUN because it was so hip. So I didn't have a chance. I mean, they were, our audition song was Cherokee at 2:30. They had to sing it in their key, and I was like falling all over myself. They tried starting it two or three times, and I just said, you know, forget it. And so the other instruments, I say, well, I play bass. And so they auditioned me on bass, and I did pretty good on that because it was single notes. Thank you. And it was within the, you know, the staff. And they offered me eventually the C band on bass. They had an A, B, and a C band, too. But I was so insulted because, you know, I had this big fish up in Sacramento. Right. And it was so stupid. I should have just done it because I could have worked my way into the guitar chair eventually. But I said no. I quit college, and I went to work at the music store. Then I started meeting musicians at the music store like we all did at Guitar Center.
Right.
So that's when I auditioned eventually for a steakhouse band that was being booked by some agent whose son used to be in the Mouseketeers on some smugglers in, you know, chain all over the country with a California copy rock band. We all wore outfits. And we played, you know, War and Santana and Carole King and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And whatever the top 40 was of that day. This was 73, you know, near the end of the summer. Right around the summer. And, you know, because things went really fast. I mean, I went down there. I tried going to see someone. I hated it. I quit. I started using a music store. I got in a fight with a biker. He was a Satan slave. He was accusing me of making, you know, whoopee with his girlfriend, who wasn't even his girlfriend. And I wasn't. She just invited me over when I listened to records. He wanted to kill me. And so he's tried to beat me up in a parking lot because I was a football player. I kicked his ass and bounced his head off the sidewalk. And he was so pissed. I did it in front of one of his friends. He was so pissed at me, he started shooting a .22 at my windshield when I come back from the mall. And so I knew I had to get out of town. This guy was, he was not well. So when they offered this gig, I went over and stayed at the bass player's house for a week while we rehearsed. I never came home. And then I finally came home, got all my stuff, moved it out, took it to my parents, went on the road for 6 months with this band, or about 8 months. And that was from probably June of 73 through March of 74. That was my first tour. I was 18, and I turned 19 on that tour.
That is crazy. And then did you leave that band and just start doing sessions and auditions or trying to work at studios?
Well, I met a girl. It was on the road there, and I brought her back to California, and she was in love with me, and she sold her wedding ring. She was just recently divorced. She sold her wedding ring to buy me stage clothes.
Wow.
Oh, God. And she was from Georgia. She was a Georgia Peach. She was a sweetheart. And she was patient with me while I auditioned for other groups. I finally got in a band that was called Titan, and they were pretty cool. And they were doing all kinds of real cool R&B stuff. This was about, you know, 70 into 74, going into 75 now. We were wearing platforms. We were starting to play Cool in the Gang tunes.
Awesome.
We became R&B guys. And we did some Stones. And we did, you know, Smoke on the Water and some other stuff. But mainly a horn kind of R&B dance band. And we were playing at Rita Del Rey. We were playing all kinds of really cool clubs and stuff. And the lead singer, I'm still friends with. He later went on to be some kind of a Broadway guy. His name is Michael Whammy. Everybody knows him. But anyway, that band was really good, and I learned a lot in that band. And then eventually got in a band called Skin Tight. This was full-on R&B now, but it was just a guitar trio. And I had a female up front named Laura Lucero, and this band was called Skin Tight. So we did a lot of Ohio Players, obviously.
Yeah, fire.
Rufus, Gladys Knight. You know, we were doing, we were doing some rock stuff. You know, we were doing David Bowie fame, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we got into the Smugglers in chain in Charlie Brown's chain, which was another steakhouse in the L.A. area.
Yeah, I remember those.
Working around doing that. We worked at Disneyland. So that band did pretty good. But I had to play all the horn parts, all the keyboard parts, all the solos. And, you know, you learn a lot as a single guitar player in a guitar trio like that. You had to play all those rhythm things. Remember, I always talk about rhythm playing. You had to play all those chord solos and rhythm plays and horn parts and stuff. You had to play all the lead solos. You had to double the bass line, certain bass lines. You had to do power chords on rock tunes. I mean, all that stuff. And back then, we didn't have pedals. I mean, I had a bassman. I had a blackface bassman with 212s that I would turn everything up to 10, and I would just back my guitar off. And I just play all the cleaner stuff with lower gain.
And what were you playing? You were playing a Strat, I assume?
Yeah, and I had a 63 Strat. When it was time to do a solo, boom, you put it all the way up to 10, and you had your overdrive.
Tell me you didn't sell that 63 Strat and you still have it.
That got stolen.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that got stolen. But so, that head, see that Showman head back there?
Yeah.
On top of it, you can't see it, but the wing is, but I still have it. It's a black covered 66 bass, or 65 bass. And that was my first good amp, and I've had it ever since.
That's amazing. So then you started playing with people. You started jamming with people, and then you eventually landed.
Well, that band, Titan, did a session. We actually went into a studio. It was the Mills Brothers studio. It was down in West Hollywood, and we rented it out, and we cut a bunch of tunes one day. And that was my first recording experience, was doing that. And then my friend Bruce came down. He recorded some demos, so I recorded with him too. I think that was before Titan. So that was my first session, was recording with him on an 8-track. And then right around the time that we started Titan, I think we might have gone to 16, but maybe not. That might have been 8 too. But that was about 75. And so Skin Tight never recorded. But then after I was done with Skin Tight, I met Diane, my wife, who at the time was a pianist and singer-songwriter who was playing around town. And she was playing the Charlie Brown's chain with her trio. But she was kind of more like a Melissa Manchester meets, you know, Roberta Flack. You know, she was a pianist who sang R&B and pop and did it really well. She had a voice kind of like Olivia Newton-John, but also like Diana Ross. Very sweet, but R&B and jazzy. And so she needed a bass player, and I just happened to be available, and she hired me, and we became friends, and we started writing songs. The next thing I know, she was doing her second album for ABC Dunhill, and the producers wanted to get David Hungate, Jeff Porcaro, and all the guys at Toto, and it was like, she goes, no, he's my bass player. He wrote the bass lines that are on these songs. He's going to do the session. So she stood up for me and forced the producers to not use David Hungate, and use me. And I went in there and I could read. And of course I wrote the charts. I mean, you know, they were my songs, you know? So I went in there and Porcaro was looking at me and he's going, let's see what this kid can do. We started cutting. He looked at me and he went,
wow.
You know, wow. Jay Graydon was on guitar. We had Kai Winding. We had William Smitty Smith. David Page was doing synths. You know, so they all gave me the nod.
That was the audition right there.
And I was playing the keyboards on this session too, along with another keyboard player, but she was cutting parts. You know, I mean, they were very impressed. Jeff had a really good time on the session. And so because of that, I got a reputation immediately that I was pretty good and I could read. So they started recommending me. And then the producer, Barry Fosman, started using me on both bass guitar and a lot of his other projects. And then I met other people through that. So I started blossoming into that studio scene. And that was about 1977. I think it was 77. Now, prior to that, I missed one little chunk in there. Between Skin Tight and meeting Diane, I had to work because Diane was now not working because she was getting ready to do her album. I went down to the Chitlin' Circuit and I got in a black band as a bass player.
Wow.
And
I
was learning how to play real true good R&B with an all black band down there.
You're doing Wilson, I know you're doing Wilson Pickett. Your father's doing Sly Stone.
Whatever the top 40 was at the time, you know. I mean, it was right. You know, Brothers Johnson. I was playing all that fun Sly, the Car Wash. Played that funky music, White Boy. You know, we were playing behind a guy named Mr. Aretha Franklin, who was a transvestite. But he sounded just like Aretha. And he was great. And he had a great background singer. Really good organist. Anyway, it was a killing band. So I got really great. So the band got really popular. And then the keyboard player went out with Mr. Aretha. They went on tour, and they needed a keyboard player. So I hired my buddy Jeff, who had introduced me to Diane, because we had done a recording project called Malibu Project. I forgot to mention that. That was with Ralph Humphrey. That was a really good one.
I'm
meeting all these people, and I get Jeff in the band. So there was two white guys in this black band down in the ghetto. And at Play That Funky Music, White Boy had just hit. And so we were totally accepted into this neighborhood and this band. I mean, we're talking about people getting knifed out on the sidewalk, you know, at night. I mean, it was rough, man. I was down in Inglewatts, you know. And so, but we were protected and we were accepted. And a lot of people came to see us because we were kind of like freaks, you know. It was kind of like, you got to a point where I was wearing, going to Fred Segal, I was getting those Muslim kind of what they call the hero outfits. And one of them had a cone monk hood.
You gotta bring that back, man.
It looked just like the Klan. And I would go up there and I'd play my bass with this cone on the mid. And the people knew, of course, I wasn't a bigot or anything, you know. In fact, I judiciously used the N-word all the time. They were like, they didn't even care at that point. They probably did, but they accepted me. I had to learn from Diane. I wasn't supposed to do that. Don't be doing that down there now. Come on. You know, and I'm like, oh, okay. Because they loved me. I mean, I was accepted. So we became very popular. That band, we recorded with that band, did a lot of projects. So I met even more people through that band recording on bass. So when Diane's album finally got going, I met the Precaros. I then exploded. I had all this experience. James Jamerson Sr. would come into that club. It was called Caribbean Lounge. He heard me play. I had the same year, same model, P bass as his. And I was that 50-watt bass, which was very similar to his B-15 Ampeg. And he came in and he just said, keep doing what you're doing, man. You sound great, kid. This was James Jamerson Sr. who played all Motown hits. So I got the nod from him. So I felt pretty confident.
You played on almost every big Motown hit.
Yep. So I got in the studio scene, and then I just started blossoming in the studio scene and doing that. Then eventually I joined this club band called the Five Mighty Pieces. And they were kind of like a show band, and they worked all the hip clubs around LA, and they were getting paid really well. And their bass player was leaving, and I got the call from my friend Keith, who had been in that Skin Tight band with me, but he was going out with Robert Fleischman at that time, who had just left Journey, and they were going on tour. So he couldn't do the auditions. He called me for this band, and I went and auditioned. I got it, and they worked all the time, and we had agents, and we were getting paid really well, and so I would do sessions all day long, and then at night, I'd go play with this great band and make more money doing that. So now, I'm in this house that I'm renting for $150 a month. With fruit trees and a big yard and a whole bit. And, in fact, Art Pepper, the sax player, was living in the one in back of me from the same landlord. And I was making some money, man. I was like 23 years old. And I was banking, man. I was making, you know, I was pulling anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 a month.
That's crazy.
That was $150 a month.
Right.
So I was doing pretty good. So I bought some studio gear. And I started writing my own stuff about, you know, 4 track TAC, which was the big deal back then. Got a nice board, got a little spring reverb stereo.
Any of that?
And eventually got a AKG 20 model stereo, you know, plate reverb, little one, the little box, you know. Sounded pretty good, actually. So, you know, things just started exploding. And then I started getting more and more studio work, more and more studio work. Then eventually I got into a studio called Fidelity Recorders, and over there they were cutting a lot of demos for April Blackwood, one of which was a writer by the name of Gerard McMahon. And he heard me playing over there. I got over there with one of those black acts. They came up to use the studio, and the engineer liked me, and he got my number, and he recommended to me to be a bass player for Gerard. And so Gerard asked me to be in his band, and the drummer for that band at that time was Gary Malibur. And Gary Malibur was the guy that played in all of Steve's hits, played on Moondance with Van Morrison.
That person, that's right.
Honey Hits, you know, played Frampton, Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt. I mean, he'd been playing with everybody, you know. And so we became friends in that band because Steve wasn't touring then. He was kind of taking a break. And then he and I started writing songs with Gerard, and then eventually we broke away from Gerard. We tried going for our own record deal with one of the guys from that band by the name of John Massaro, who was a really great singer. And so between the three of us, we had a really great songwriting team. And Lonnie Turner and Greg Douglas, who had toured with Gary prior with the big songs that Steve had written, you know, with Fly Like an Eagle and Book of Dreams, they came in also and started writing with us at Gary's studio. And all those songs we came up with, eventually eight of them become the Abracadabra album for Steve Miller Band.
That's crazy.
Because Steve was looking for material, and he was dry. And he was coming off of a break, and he needed songs. And we had them, and that's how I met Steve.
So you were on that record.
Yeah, yeah, because what happened was is that he liked our masters that we cut in Gary's studio so much that he transferred our 80-8 8-track with DBX masters to a 24-track machine, took them over to Capitol, and just kept building on those and singing on those. And I was already on bass and guitar on most of those tracks, so I was already on his album by way of transfer.
That is wild.
Yeah. And so I never thought I was going to be in his band. He calls me up one day and says, come on down here. I love your songs. I love your playing. Help me produce this record. So I helped him produce the Abracadabra song, which was another song called Macho Children. And we told him he needed to change the lyrics. And, you know, we worked with him on it. And he did. And they came up with I Want to Reach Out and Grab You, which was wow. And then we put the whip on. And then I was helping him with the solo because I showed him how to tune his guitar the Eddie Van Halen style, where you just bend down only and you just put a block and it only bends down but not up and it stops, you know, on a Strat. And he was so excited because this was before locking systems. He was going wah, 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 all day long because, you know, it would stay in tune because you tune each string separately and when you put it down to the floor, they'd all pop back to the same spot. Put a little graphite on the net, you know. This was an Eddie Van Halen technique that I learned through Steve Sykes. And so anyway, his girlfriend walks in the studio and she's all dressed up looking hot. And he does the cat call. Row, row. He goes, whir, whir, with the Xbox sign. He goes, row, 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 on the guitar because he didn't have a talkback mic. He just wanted to communicate with her with the guitar. And that's when the engineer, Gary, and I got on the talkback and said, that's your solo. Quit playing all this Carlos Santana stuff you're trying to do. And sound effects solo. And we'll put those in stereo and we'll put a whip in there and this will be like a sound effects thing. It won't be like a conventional solo. Because you remember, this was 1981, 82, and the English New Wave thing was huge.
Right.
And nobody was digging all that old stuff. You know, they wanted something new. So
fresh.
We made that album into a newer sounding Steve Miller. He sounded like an 80s updated Steve Miller. And that's why it sold 5 million copies.
That's crazy. And you've been in the band ever since.
Well, I mean, I still wasn't in the band yet. I mean, I helped them with that. And then I get a call one day. I'm getting ready to go to another session, you know, probably playing on a Rocky soundtrack with Bill Conti or something. Who knows? And he calls. He goes, hey, I'm taking photos tomorrow for the album cover. He goes, what do you think about going on the road and joining the band?
Wow.
And I said, well, I'd have to think about that because I'm doing pretty good in the studios here. I said, you know, when you go and you join a band and you leave town, you lose all your clients, all your contractors and stuff are depending on you to be there because you're part of a team and they depend on you. Most of those guys aren't even players. They're just contractors, but their team makes them look good. You know, because then you cut that stuff one take, you save everybody money because the studio is expensive. You know, the record label's trying to keep everything trim and, you know, that's why they want you. So I had to really consider that. And so Diane, at that time, who I'm still not married to, she's just my girlfriend. I kind of put it over to her, you know, because she was wise and was in the industry longer than me. She says, well, you've already had three record deals. You did your Pieces record. Oh, God, I forgot to tell you about Pieces. Oh, the band that Five My Pieces, we changed to Pieces. We made a record on UA Liberty. It was great, but it was Blue Eyed Soul, and the Knack had just hit with My Sharona, and you no longer could have Blue Eyed Soul with a white group. Right. You had to be a black group to do soul music.
Right.
So the record went away. And then the two records that we did with Gerard. So I'd already had three records that I'd written songs on and even sang lead on, and none of them had ever taken off. And I'm getting antsy. You know, I want to hit. And so Diane says, well, you've already had three record deals. you've tried selling your own stuff. Here's a chance. If you go out and promote your own material, it's just that a guy named Steve Miller is going to be singing it, and he's already got a built-in audience, so it'll probably sell. So it won't be a bad decision, you know.
Right.
It was tough, you know, so because, you know, I told a couple contractors what I was doing, and they just said, don't ever call me again. I don't want to hear from you. You're joining Rock Band. You're letting me down. You're quitting.
Wow. The team.
And sure enough, when I came back, Nathan East had all my gigs because he had just come
wow.
to San Diego, and he could read, and he played really good. And he wanted to stand down and do records. And so Nathan became the guy. And Lewis Johnson, because I knew Lewis and I were already playing back-to-back gigs, but he would get the calls for the thumb popping, even though I could do that too. But I get all the calls for the reading because he couldn't read. So
right.
Lewis would get those gigs, and I'd get these gigs. So we kind of split those up. But then when Nathan showed up and he could do almost all of it, he just took them all.
He was the guy. But you didn't do so bad. You were one of the biggest rock bands.
No. Here's the deal. We sold a lot of records. I made some money on that record because I had songs on it and I had a flip side of Abracadabra. But he didn't tour again after that tour we did. And we only did one gig in 84 at Rock Palace. And, you know, that was just one song. And then we didn't tour at all. And then, so there wasn't any touring coming in. The royalties had already kind of come and gone. I bought a house and a studio. That was nice. But I had to pay for it now. You know, there wasn't any of that money coming in. And so it would have been nice to have had all those sessions again. So I tried getting back into the studio scene, and I got a few clients back, and, you know, I started working again, but it wasn't like it was because I was starting to go viral,
right.
You know, as a player. And, you know, I was playing catch up after that tour with Steve.
Well, I remember, you know, you and I worked in Guitar Center 2003, and I just remember talking to you, and you were like a hustler in the store. And I just remember like talking to you, and you would tell me how you were a road warrior with all these crazy bands that I was growing up listening to, and it blew my mind. And you were telling me about the craziest sessions you've been doing, and I was like, this guy is a beast of a guitar player. You should be back on the road. But you're like, it changes. The road's so inconsistent, and studios can also be like that too, you know?
Well, I hate to shamefully promote my YouTube channel and my guitar lesson site now, but on my YouTube channel now, Kenny Lee Lewis on YouTube, Fret Friends playlist, and also my website, FretFrenz, FRETFRENZ.com, which is a lesson site. I teach this stuff. I teach about how you have to be so well-faceted in the music business in order to survive it. You can't just be a writer. You can't just be a guitar player. You
yep.
can't be a singer. You can't just be an entertainer. You can't be a band, just be a band leader. You've got to be a salesman. You've got to be a gear. You've got to go out and train. You've got to teach.
Yes.
You have to do seminars. You have to, you know, you have to deliver stuff. You have to, you know, all that stuff, you know, do what it takes at Guitar Center, not only in selling gear, but also all of the stuff that you do is what you bring to the table and your skill set as a player. You have to make sure that this rough diamond is being faceted on every edge.
I love that you just said all this because this is what I tell students. This is what I tell friends.
Yeah, because you're never going to make – you're going to hit a slump. You're going to try to depend on just a group of skill sets. You have to have all of them going on, all of
it. Right. Well, let's bring it – bring it up to this new record you have. First of all, you have an oxymoron as the title, New Vintage. Somehow you came up with that, and you're doing this jazz record. What inspired you to do a jazz record? I love that you're doing a jazz record.
Well, it's not new, but it is for sale. I mean, you know, and you can download it. I have a lot of other material, and you were kind of kicking my ass by asking me about sending stuff because I should have been sending you new stuff that I already have that is up on CD Baby and ready to stream. But I just have been remiss in all the other projects and touring and stuff the last couple of years.
All right, that's all right.
This YouTube channel and this lesson channel, I just have ignored putting my original material up online because, let's face it, it doesn't pay very well.
Right.
I need to pay bills, and my bills are steep. I got a nice place. I live up here in SLO. I got a nice place. I got some bills. So I got to have some serious cake coming in. Songwriting and streaming ain't going to pay for it.
Right.
Not. I mean, unless you're some big, giant, you know, boy band or some, you know, diva or something. But, you know, but there is trickle money that comes in, and I should service that. So I have new stuff that I need to put out there, which I will soon. But this jazz record you're speaking of, I started working on that on the road in 2005.
Wow.
You know, so that goes way back. So around 2006-07, I finally started getting the tracks developed. I got into the studio in Minneapolis. Some of the guys in the Steve Miller Band, they're well-known. The Petersons, Ricky plays on, who's in Fleetwood Mac right now. Our old bass player, Billy, played on it. Paul Peterson, who's played, he was in Purple Rain with the time for crying out loud. The Olita Adams and Kenny Loggins and a whole bunch of other people. He's on it. And the saxophone player for Michael Bolton, he's on it. He's their cousin. So I got all these celebrity guys. And then our drummer, Gordy, is the drummer on it. It's called New Vintage. And I wanted to do a record that was kind of like George Benson meets Terry Caff meets awesome. Me, you know. But it was instrumental, even though there's some oohs and ahs on it and stuff. It was a legitimate, smooth jazz, but with a lot of pepper in it. You know, it's not snooze. We call snooze jazz is that really lame stuff that's really, oh, this has got a little more fire to it, but it's still considered, you know, cool meets smooth. So that is for sale on CD Baby. You have some tracks there. I sent you.
Yeah, what do you want to play first? Let's play something.
Well, you know, why don't you play that the title track, which is, what was the title track? Oh, Get 2D Point. Instead of 3D, it was 2D. Get 2D Point. This is just a jam that I wrote with Jimmy Kaliri, who's a great keyboard player out of Ojai. He used to be in a band called Raven years ago back on Columbia, and I just sort of arranged it. And it's just a fun jam. And then we'll play something more jazzy later.
But go ahead and do that one. Here's Kenny Lee Lewis, Get 2D Point. Thank you. Yeah, man, that was slamming. By the way, that guitar solo was crazy, dude.
Yeah, I mean, I really dig Ricky Peterson. He sounds like Joey DeFrancesco at the end there. There was actually two organ players on that, which is funny. He didn't like playing in the key of F, so I had to have the engineer play the solo, the first solo, which was an F. Ricky says, I sound like a country MF when I play an F. So
what's great, it's got like a New Orleans vibe. It's got like a Modesky Martin Wood kind of vibe.
That's what it was like. Exactly.
Yeah, man. It's really slamming.
It's like it's hybrid jazz with R&B and rock tendencies, you know.
Well, I love it because it's like, you know, I've always known you as a great player, but whenever I see you with Steve Miller, you're playing for the music. But I know you got those chops, like crazy chops, and I just heard it. I was hooting and hollering during your solo because it's like you're laying it out there and you're doing it so tastefully, man. That's just
and it's on flat wounds with a wound G.
Crazy. I mean, some of those licks, it was like whoa, you know, it was awesome. So let's talk a little bit about like some of the players you played with. You played with some of the biggest names in music: Bonnie Raitt, Paul McCartney, BB King, Todd Rundgren, who's just about to be inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You play with a Hall of Famer currently. Are there any sessions or particular moments that you were like, pinch me, this is crazy that I'm working with this person?
I would have to probably be a live thing. I didn't play on any really, I played bass on a song called Thanks But No Thanks, which I actually played on the whole album, which is a Billy Preston album. A lot of people don't know about. But, you know, since he was the fifth Beatle, I mean, it was really an honor to be able to play bass on that album. And I was doing a lot of that Louis Johnson thumb slapping technique and all that stuff. So that was unbelievable working with Billy Preston.
Was he in the room when you were doing all the stuff?
Oh, yeah. No, he was at the sessions and was there. We kind of produced him. It was my band. It was my pieces band. We were doing disco records in Europe out of Belgium, and we actually had a number one dance hit. If you can listen to it on YouTube, it was called All My Lovin', and the band's called LAX. That's my band, Pieces. Again, like I said, you know, the Knack came and killed our record because Blue Eyed Soul was out, because we sounded like Pablo Cruz meets, you know, Hall & Oates, you know. They weren't allowing that anymore with white bands, you know.
You got to put all that stuff up on Spotify or YouTube just to have it up there, man.
Yeah, so all of our stuff's on YouTube. So that was a song called All My Lovin'. But anyway, that became a hit, and then we started making more of those records, and then we became producers, and that's when we started producing other artists, and that's when we snagged Billy Preston. And so we wrote the songs for him, we produced the record for him, and we played on it.
Did you play with him when he had the fro?
Yeah, as he did, as a matter of fact, because this was about 80, I'm going to say this was about 80, 81, something like that.
That's
for a while, you know.
That's wild, dude. He's one of my favorite musicians.
But, you know, the other thing you mentioned was Paul McCartney. Diana and I, in fact, I just put it up on Facebook a couple months ago. I don't know if you saw it, but.
Yeah, I did. He came up to you and said, come out and sing Hey Jude.
Diana and I got to go up and sing with him on Hey Jude along with Ringo. And I have a video of it, and I have still photos of that. And I just met him that night. And then, of course, now when I meet him, I always go, well, I was that night. It was great. You know, but, you know, that was great. And I meet Ringo all the time because my friend Greg Bissonette plays drums with him, and Lukather plays guitar. And we meet them all the time on the road, and we end up hanging out together. So I ended up working out with Ringo one day in the gym. It was fun.
I met Paul McCartney once at Ocean Way when he was doing Chaos and Creation in the Backyard, and I was doing my first record. That was pretty humbling just to be across the hall from him while he was working. And then I met him another time right after the Hollywood Bowl show in L.A., and I met him outside the Four Seasons. Just like driving home, I saw his bus, I parked the car, jumped out, and got my ticket stub signed, and that's what's hanging above my piano, man. So let's play something else. What do you want to play from your other record?
Well, I mean, we should probably end with the down one because that'll kind of bring everybody down. Let's keep the energy up. Go ahead and play that song Together for the Very Last Time. This shows that other side of me that you probably know pretty well, which is more of like a Stevie Ray Hendrixian kind of a you know, thing with the Texas Shuffle thrown in. This original song I wrote about how sometimes people get together and they have a really tumultuous relationship and they break up, but because of sensual feelings and, you know, whatever, they end up getting back together again, and they break up again, they get back together again. I've known quite a few couples that have broken up and gotten back together, divorced and remarried, actually.
Wow, wow.
So this is called Together for the Very Last Time.
Love it. Here's Kenny Lee Lewis, Together for the Very Last Time.
Crank it up.
Messing up our lives. We gotta pull it all together. Together for the very last time. Well, I knew when I first saw you, I wanted to share my life. In you, I saw a future as my ex-wife. Oh, yeah. And I still want you to be mine. Together for the very last time. And here's what we gotta do. We'll get up and try to give it our very best shot. We'll get up, pick up the pieces, whether or not. We'll get up, we fit together like a hand in a glove. I don't know where we started, but it can't be love. We run around in circles, find our way. It would be a miracle if we could last one day. Oh yeah. But I still want you to be mine all the time. We gotta pull it all together. Together for the very last time.
Oh yeah.
Slamming, dude.
I was surprised at how slow that was, because I do that with my band all the time. We played a little faster, obviously.
Well, you have times are changing, man.
Yeah, but that pocket was deep, man. That was deep. That's a Texas Shuffle, man. It's deep.
And you totally did the Steve Ray thing, man. That's what I love, like on all those little licks and even the pattern that you're playing. Amazing. We're going to close with one last tune as we fade out. But Kenny Lee Lewis, where can people find you? Where can people find you on YouTube? Just give us all the handles.
Okay, well, the basic website is just kennyleelewis.com. That has my bio and my information. There's a guitar solo on there with the Steve Miller Band that I'm pretty proud of. You know, there's some links. I wrote a book called Skeleton Dolls. It's on Amazon. You can see the link on there. It's been well received, and I'm looking for an agent right now. So I write novels too, sci-fi novels. And then, like I mentioned earlier, the YouTube channel, Kenny Lee Lewis, go to Fret Friends, F-R-E-T-F-R-E-N-Z. And then also the teaching website, which is a subscription website, is F-R-E-T-F-R-E-N-Z, all one word, .com. There's a free trial on there, and there's also some sample lessons, so you can see if you like it. And I also have three different Facebook artist pages now. I have a band called Barflies, Barflyz music.com website. You can see what I do with my wife and that band. Another one called Friends Music, F-R-E-N-Z music.com. That's a website. There's a video on there. And then I have a new band that I just debuted last Saturday. It's a Latin jazz, you know.
Dude, what are you not doing?
Band. That's called Supernova. And I'm going to start putting some stuff up tonight, as a matter of fact, up on YouTube on that. And, you know, but there's basically it. And then CD Baby is where you can get New Vintage, which is that first song you heard. So, you know, if you only got time for one song, I'd probably just play Why Can't I Fall in Love. That was the one that I had in a Christian Slater movie on Pump Up the Volume. This is interesting because I'm playing a gig this Saturday in a garage up in Sacramento with my high school band, the one that was called Standing Man.
Awesome.
They played on this track you're about ready to play at a reunion we did in the studio, and we did it in one take, no overdubs. I played the solo and sang the lead vocal live with my high school band. And it was so good, I had to put it on this Barflies Blues album that I have, which I can't sell, unfortunately, because of contractual reasons. But you can enjoy it. And but this song here, you can get if I put it up. I had, because this one is not a part of that deal. Anyway, this is called Why Can't I Fall in Love. It was originally sung by Ivan Neville, and Randy Jackson was the bass player on it. But this is my high school band doing the same song in a movie called Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater in 1990.
Amazing. Kenny, you've been a wonderful guest. We're going to play this last song, but thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. A wonderful soul. You're a wonderful musician. Keep on the good hustling, because I know I'll see you at some giant stadium or arena soon. But thank you for blessing the world with your music, man, and your gifts. It really is a great, great thing.
Thanks for inviting me, Nikki. I appreciate it.
We'll see you soon. We'll have you back. Okay. Here's Kenny Lewis with, what's the name of the song one more time?
Why Can't I Fall in Love?
Why Can't I Fall in Love? Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
So many people go walking by, looking so happy, while all I do is cry. I just wanna be with somebody too. What I'd give for a kiss, what am I gonna do? Why can't I fall in love? Why must it always be someone else? She's out there waiting, so why can't I fall in love? Maybe now I see it's always been me. I thought I was better off in my misery. It's time to get real, change where I'm at. That same old question keeps a whole world in me back. Why can't I fall in love? Why must be real.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.